Welcome, friends, and thank you as always to John Lee Hooker and Carlos Santana for their cooperation in producing such a wonderful way of affirming the change that's coming. This is Economic Update, a program brought to you every week by the Pacifica Network. Our purpose here is to analyze major economic events and trends, the forces shaping our jobs, incomes, taxes, debts, all the things we buy and what we pay for those goods and services upon which we all together depend. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. I now teach as a visiting professor in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write columns of economic analysis for the website truthout.org, a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary every day. Thank you, as always, for sending in your questions and comments. We read every one and select the few we can respond to on the air, but also use them in shaping our planning for each program we produce. Send your questions and comments to our website, democracyatwork.info. Let us know if you would like us to identify you by name, and we will be glad to do so. In our opening section of updates, I want to pick up on one that we discussed briefly last week. And that has to do with a remarkable scandal spreading across Europe. It has to do with horse meat. That's right. Horse meat has been substituted for beef without telling anyone in food preparations in Ireland, England, France, Holland, Germany, and it's spreading more and more with each passing day. It is partly not dangerous in the sense that eating horse meat has been done in many parts of Europe for a long time, but it is at the best dishonest and at worst dangerous because the horses and the horse meat are not inspected very well, and some horses have been injected with buta, it's a drug, for pain killing, and that's dangerous for people. I wanted to inquire what lesson we might draw from this scandal. And I think there are two basic explanations. First, over the last year or two, the price of beef has skyrocketed in Europe, whereas the price of horse meat has gone the other way down. So here becomes a profit opportunity that clearly all kinds of businesses across Europe have found irresistible. To keep charging a price associated with high quality and high cost beef, but make a lot of money by substituting low quality, low price horse meat. So there's the profit motive driving this event. But there's a second phenomenon. Everywhere in Europe, there are austerity programs run by the governments to try to cope with the crisis. And one result is to cut government spending. You know the story. Every conservative business group virtually is pushing for it. And when you cut government spending, one of the things you cut are government inspection agencies and government inspectors. There were too few of them, it turns out. They didn't check the meat quality. They didn't check the health of the horses. They didn't check what was going into the food preparations. And as a result, we got this scandal. Here's the lesson. There are those who support the profit motive as some special guarantor of prosperity and growth. They don't like to face the fact that the profit motive also produces horse meat scandals. And then the same groups tend to like the government should cut spending, but they don't want to face the fact that if you have less inspection and you couple that with the profit motive, you get a horse meat scandal. And lest anyone think that this is peculiar to Europe, I just learned of a report by a wonderful nonprofit group called Oceana. You can check them out at oceana.org. They just completed a 2-year study running from 2010 to 2012 on the fish industry here in the United States. And they wanted to check whether the fish you thought you were buying or eating was indeed the fish that you were eating. And here's what they found. A national mislabeling rate of 74%, roughly one out of three of the tests they made, and this was tests on fish eaten at a restaurant, fish bought in a retail store, and so on, across the board. And again, you can read their new report at oceana.org. And here's some examples of what they found. The biggest source of fraud was in the sushi restaurant business. That's right. Those restaurants were substituting fish on a stunning scale. Here's one example. Significant substitution of escolar for white tuna. This occurred, according to one report, 84% of the time. Now, why is that important? Well, tuna is a major item in many sushi menus. Escolar is a completely different fish, has nothing to do with tuna, is nicknamed the Ex-lax fish. It is, in fact, what is usually called in biology a snake mackerel and not a tuna. And it can cause serious digestive issues for some people who eat more than a few ounces. The Food and Drug Administration in Washington warns against eating this fish in large portions, and it is banned in Italy and Japan. Let me repeat that. Japan, which is where sushi comes from, does not let you eat what a large number of sushi joints substitute for tuna. I won't go into all the details, but they are remarkable. What do they show? Again, the same thing as the horse meat scandal in Europe. The profit motive, which is clearly indicated in the Oceana report, drives businesses across the board to substitute lower-cost fish while charging for the higher-cost fish that they fraudulently claim to be selling you or serving you. So it's the profit motive again. And side by side, cutbacks in government spending, which always sounds so good, but which involve, among other things, cutting back on the inspectors who could have and who should have done a lot more to protect us, especially in a society that enjoys eating more and more fish for health reasons. What an irony this story entails. The next story, the next update, has to do with work and how much work people do. And I'm going to get at this one in two different ways. First, I'm going to talk about a scandal rocking France these days, but involving the United States. Front page news across all French newspapers, radio, television, is the following. The Goodyear Tire Company, an American company, has been planning for some years now to close a factory that makes tires in France, in the French city of Amiens. And the workers there, who are part of a union, have been fighting that, wanting to preserve their jobs. And they have called upon the government to help them, which it has done, in a variety of ways. Part of that had to do with negotiating a sale, a possible sale of the Goodyear Tire Company to another American tire company called Titan International, whose colorful chairman, Maurice Taylor, is at the center of this struggle. The government tried to get Mr. Taylor and Titan to buy the factory on the condition of preserving most, if not all, of the jobs. They were back and forth for a couple of years, and then it kind of blew up this month when the government asked Mr. Titan again to resume conversations, and Mr. Taylor, or the head of Titan, explained his reasons for refusing to come back. Now, I'm going to quote to you from the letter released by Mr. Taylor and the Titan International Corporation to the French government. Quote, "Sir, your letter says you want Titan to start a discussion. How stupid do you think we are? Titan is the one with the money and the talent to produce tires. What does the crazy union have? It has the French government." Wow. Not the kind of letter you normally send to a government in whose country you are doing business. But Mr. Taylor went further. He said his company would do the following, and I think this is a lesson for every listener to this program. Here's what he said. "We will now produce cheaper tires in India or China. There we can pay workers less than €1 an hour. That'd be about $1.35 an hour. And then we'll sell the tires right back to the French. Your company, Michelin, the famous French tire company, won't be able to compete with that, and we'll have to stop all production in France within 5 years. Let me quote again. You can keep your so-called workers. Titan is not interested in that factory. Wow. Here's a statement by a leading capitalist in the United States, tire producer, denouncing the French for not working hard enough. His argument is that they don't want to take over a factory where workers get paid as well as they have been there and where they don't work long enough hours. Besides the amazing demand and the threat involved here, the threat that if you don't do more work for less money, we're going to go to another country where we can get exactly that. And then we're going to bring the goods back here, and you'll have no job at all. That threat is being made by capitalist enterprises across the world, and nowhere more than in the United States. In the light of that, I thought you might be interested in the following statistic. This comes from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, usually referred to as the OECD. It's a measurement of the average annual hours worked per worker. Average annual hours worked. In other words, how many hours of paid labor does an average worker do? And in the chart they provided, they compared how this has developed over the last half century, that's right, from around the 1950s and 60s to 2012. Here are the numbers. Back in the 1950s and 60s, workers in France and Japan worked many more hours per year than their American counterparts. Even in countries like the Netherlands and Germany, workers worked almost as much as the Americans. But here is the stunning fact revealed by the OECD. Over the last 50 years, the number of hours worked annually per worker has dropped dramatically in France and Japan. And it has dropped also quite spectacularly in the Netherlands and Germany. In every one of those countries, France, Japan, Netherlands, Germany, and it's true for other countries too, but these are the ones focused on by the OECD. In every case, the drop in hours work far exceeded the much, much smaller drop here in the United States. So that by 2012, Americans did more average hours of work, paid work per year, than all of those other countries. More than Japan, even, and much more than France, Germany, or the Netherlands. In short, workers in Europe are used to and demand shorter working hours, shorter working years. They have much more leisure. And while they have much more leisure, they don't have that much less of a money income. So Mr. Taylor is right. The workers in Europe do work less than the Americans, and certainly less than the Chinese and the Indians, and they get paid as well. Wow. How strange it is that they would want to continue to have those resources. And how remarkable is the threat of the capitalist in this situation? You must do more, you must accept less, because if you don't, I'll leave and you'll have no job at all. Of course, the crucial question is there, will they be permitted to leave? Will they be permitted to carry out the threat? Because in the end, of course, as one French official pointed out to Mr. Taylor in response, you can be very sure that we will be taking a long, hard look at the tires that come from India and from China before we let them in to our country and to destroy the economic well-being we've built up over the many years. Third economic update for today is a short one. It has to do with a small country in Latin America, Ecuador, which had an election this past week in which Rafael Correa, the leader of that country, won handily another term and a victory in the election. The reason I bring it up is because of the policy followed in that country to deal with the economic crisis of global capitalism that every country is dealing with one way or another. What's interesting about Mr. Correa's victory was that he takes a policy that is the exact opposite of austerity. That is, he doesn't cut government spending on the mass of people. He has done exactly the opposite. He has spent in all kinds of ways to try to reduce the poverty that is endemic in Ecuador, and he's been extraordinarily successful, from an official poverty rate of 64% to one measured last year at 27%, by providing medical services, jobs, wage increases, and so forth. You might say that Mr. Correa is doing a massive program to build the economy up from the bottom rather than taking care at the top. He's actually increased taxes on corporations. He's gotten a bigger chunk of the oil revenue. Ecuador has been able to produce and export oil. And so he is a little bit like Franklin Roosevelt was in the 1930s in the United States. He's taxing the rich to help the poor, and using that as a way to cope with and get out of the crisis. And his reward for that was a stunning electoral victory, keeping him in office by the mass of people who want him to do exactly that. Finally, I have talked about this before, but it keeps coming up, so I wanted to deal with it again. And as some of you have communicated information to me that makes it possible, and so I want to do that. This has to do with a remarkable process here in the United States. Sports teams have an expense, and the expense is called a big stadium, where the football game or the basketball game or the baseball game has to be played. This is a very lucrative arrangement. You can charge high prices for tickets. You can have luxury boxes where people can have meals and entertainment while they watch the game. And you can sell to television the right to broadcast the game. And you get a lot of money for that. What's interesting in the United States is the increasing tendency of the folks who run sports teams to pull in government money, that is, your money, my money, taxpayer money, to help pay for these stadiums. And even though the public is asked to pay, and I'm going to give you in a minute the numbers, it turns out that all of the profits are privatized. The example I want to start with is one in New York City. It's in Brooklyn, one of the boroughs of New York City. It's called the Barclays Center. It's been a very important venue for sports, particularly basketball, but it has also been the center, it's 18,000 seats, for high-profile acts like the Rolling Stones, Justin Bieber, Barbra Streisand, and Jay-Z, among others. Wow. It's named after the Barclays Bank. You know, we've talked about them before. They're the ones that have been fined hundreds of millions of dollars for all sorts of corrupt activities in Britain and elsewhere. The Barclays Center. Big center built in Brooklyn, disposed of or displaced 3,000 residents from their homes. It cost $4 billion, that's B, with billion with a B. But $2 billion of that was the public's money, public help provided particularly through the good offices of Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York. The money earned in that arena goes to the private interests who built it and who run it, even though half of the money needed for it was provided by the public. There are plenty more examples. Last week, the NFL said it might, notice this, might contribute some capital to the construction of a new stadium for the Raiders.
Wow.
The 49ers have a new field under construction in Santa Clara, but it is backed by tax-exempt bonds issued by the California Stadium Authority. You know what that means? It means that a tax-exempt bond can be floated, which pays much lower interest. It's a benefit to the people building because they can borrow money much below what they would otherwise have to pay. And the reason for that is everyone who lends to them at this lower interest rate is willing to do it because such interest is tax exempt. That's right, California will not tax the interest paid by the 49ers for that money. And when the government of California doesn't tax the rich people who lend, it means the rest of us have to pay more. It's more ways of pulling in public money. It's also true, for example, in the Lucas Oil Stadium, where the Indianapolis Colts perform. That stadium was funded, get this, by $615 million from Indiana taxpayers and $100 million from the NFL. Yet all the profits generated in the stadium are theirs. Here's a thought. If public money makes possible the stadium and the event that is televised for everybody else, then why should all the profits from that go just to the private sector? Why are there not profits paid to the public, which has been asked and has agreed to help build these things? What a remarkable idea. Maybe we ought to have public broadcast of the games. Of course, that would lower the money going to the private broadcast, but it would make all of that cheaper for us, more accessible for us, and in a sense repay the public for its portion of funding these stadiums. As we turn now to our more in-depth economic analyses, I want to talk a little bit about this phenomena of internships. Over 1.5 million Americans are currently occupying that kind of work, and I want us to understand what it means. Up until the 1930s, internships and interns were really only known in the field of medicine. There was an old practice, the idea that between finishing medical school, a doctor should have some kind of apprenticeship, you might say, before entering into regular practice. And this in-between period, often a couple of years, was called internship. Typically, you worked in a hospital where you learned all kinds of things that would be useful to you in the transition from education to practice. It was good for the hospitals because they got interns to work for little or no money. It was good for older doctors because they could take younger ones, these interns, bill the public for the services these interns helped to produce while paying the interns little or nothing. The interns accepted it for a long time as a kind of necessary rite of passage, but they were comforted in knowing that for the vast majority of these interns, they would eventually become doctors and then be able to do to the next group of young people what had been done to them. Maybe not a beautiful system, but it worked in the medical profession. Then in the 1930s, internships spread to other fields, publishing, business administration, several. And more abuses showed up as working people were required to do all kinds of menial tasks, that people were fired in order to make room, paid people for interns, and so on. And it led to protests, and it led to the passing of another one of those remarkable laws in the 1930s. This one was called the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. It lays out a 6-point test still in use today for hiring unpaid interns. I'm going to read the 6 points in the hopes that you or someone you know who's an intern will be able to recognize whether they are indeed being treated according to what the law specifies. Here are the 6 points. 1. The internship must be similar to training that would be given in an educational environment. 2. The internship must be for the benefit of the intern. 3. The intern does not displace regular employees. 4. The employer derives no immediate advantage from the intern. 5. The intern is not entitled to a job at the end of the internship. And 6. The intern understands that he or she is not entitled to wages. Clearly, a deal in which the worker foregoes wages in order to get education and a whole lot of other benefits. If you're not getting that, and you're an intern or you know someone who is, that's a violation of the law. But now fast forward to the crisis that hits in 2007. Internships explode across the country. It even started in the 1990s to zoom up. For example, in 1992, according to the National Association of Colleges and Employers, 17% of college graduates had held an internship by the time they graduated. In 2008, the number had risen to 50%, and half of those get no pay whatsoever. In other words, in a time of economic difficulty, corporations are finding interns to be a way of lowering their labor costs, which is exactly what the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 says is illegal. What is the issue here? The issue is very old. This has nothing to do with learning about a business. That was always necessary. Anytime any business has ever hired a new person to do a job, there's a period of learning. That's part of what work is. The only question is, do you pay an employee for the learning period or not? What the reality is that corporations see in interns a way to reduce or eliminate their costs, and they're taking advantage of it. Why? Because we have high unemployment. Why? Because young people coming out of college and coming out of high school are very worried, rightly, about their job prospects. They will take internships because they're desperate. And taking advantage of that means that young people who before could have, would have, and should have been paid for learning about the job they're expected to do are now required not to be paid. And that, of course, means they'll have less money to spend, and therefore that will be a depression on an already depressed economy. Final point. It's clear that some internships are a hope for a chance to get a good job. And that means that people will compete for those kinds of internships. And, of course, to be an intern is a burden because you work, often for years, and you get paid little or nothing. Who can afford to do that? The children of wealthy people, because they have other supports. So the whole system also discriminates against those unable to have the luxury of working for nothing. This is a capitalist system producing perverse results, and there's no other way to say it.
I don't care what you do, I don't care what you say, I don't care where you go, or how long you stay. Someday, baby, you ain't gonna work for me anymore. Well, you take my money, and you turn me out. You fill me up with nothing but self-doubt. Someday, baby, you ain't gonna worry for me anymore. When I was young.
This discussion of a major issue is one that responds to many questions and comments that come in. I'm gratified, to tell you the truth, that so many of the people listening to this program around the world are interested or becoming newly interested or reinterested in Marxian economic theory, because it is a neglected area from which much can be learned. That's right. That's a view that I've had for quite a while. Marxian economics, for me, as a professional economist, is a way of looking at the capitalist system from a critical standpoint. It's important for anyone interested in how this system works that we live with to have the perspective not only of people who celebrate capitalism and admire it and like it. By all means, we should listen to what they have to say to interrogate their perspective. But it is simply short-sighted and naive to think you can only learn from those who celebrate something without also learning from those who criticize it. Marx is a critic of capitalism. He's just as much the product of capitalism as are the celebrants. Every economic system in the history of the world, for example, those before capitalism, like slave economic systems, feudal economic systems in which most people are self-employed rather than in the capitalist system of employer-employee relations, in any of them, they had their celebrants and they had their critics. And if you want to understand any social phenomena, including an economic system, you need to think about and to engage those who like it and those who criticize it in order to draw your own conclusions. We haven't done that in the United States for the last 50 years. After World War II, with the Cold War, the fact that the Soviet Union was presented as our arch enemy and that they were celebrants of Marxian theory meant that in the United States, all discussions of Marxian theory, and indeed all discussions of critical perspectives towards capitalism, were pretty much thought to be inappropriate, unwise, and maybe even treasonous. So they didn't have much of a debate about capitalism. Political leaders, academic leaders, most folks fell all over themselves to celebrate it. We got a very lopsided conversation. So it's not at all surprising that after a while, the lopsidedness of that would begin to grate on people. And it's not surprising that in a time of great economic crisis for this capitalist system, the rediscovery and reinterest in Marxian economics is happening on a global scale, as indeed it is. So let's review the basic contribution so we're all on the same page, especially if some of you are reading this material or want to explore it further or want to have me discuss it further, which I'm, of course, happy to do. Here's Marx's idea. In every economic system, there's a part of the population that does work. That's right, goes out there, uses brains and muscles to transform the materials provided by nature into the goods and services we want. Think of the example of people who transform wood, glue, nails, and hammers into chairs and other kinds of furniture. The wood and so forth is provided by nature. Human beings convert all of that into finished products. Well, here's what is true of every society, every economic system. Not all the people in any society do this kind of work. Some do, some don't. We know of some examples, obviously. Little children don't do that kind of work. Elderly people, ill people, all kinds of people don't do that work. That means, if you're not going to allow all those people to die, it means that those who do the work must always produce more than what they themselves consume. That is, they have to produce enough not only to feed, clothe, and shelter themselves, but to provide food, clothing, shelter, and so on to all of those in the community who are not also workers. Marx called this output, that which is produced above and beyond what the workers themselves have to consume to keep going, the surplus. Slaves obviously produce a surplus. They do all the work in a slave economic system. They get back from their masters enough to live on, maybe more. But there's an extra that the slaves produce way above what is given back to them, and that surplus is the receipt of the master. And the master uses it to keep this system going, since the master is quite pleased, typically in slavery, to continue to be a master. The same is true in a feudal system. If you have a plantation with feudal serfs, they produce on the land more than they themselves get to keep for themselves and their families. The other goes, the surplus, the extra output goes to the lord in feudal structures. And that's why the lords' homes, the mansions, the castles in Europe and all of that are monuments that we still look at. Here's Marx's idea. Capitalism, which comes after the breakdown of feudalism in Europe, presented itself, Marx said, as the end of what? Not of the production of surplus, but the end, in his view, of anything inappropriate about this surplus. In other words, it said that everybody who participated in production kind of got his or her fair share out of it. We didn't have any more a system, as we had had in slavery and feudalism, in which a lot of people produce more than they get, and a relatively small number of people get that surplus, get that into their hands, which was clearly the case in slavery and in feudalism. Marx disagreed. And the central point of Marx's argument was to show that capitalism also is a system in which most people work to produce a surplus that a small number of people get and use to keep that system going. In a sense, he burst capitalism's bubble. He said it wasn't what the French revolutionaries had thought, a system premised on liberty, equality, and fraternity. It was, in fact, Marx said, just another form of many people producing a surplus that a small number of people get, who are different from the workers, a situation Marx called exploitation. And here's his argument as simply as I can put it. And I'm going to rely here on what most of you who are listening to this already know. When you go and look for a job in the private sector producing a good or a service, you sit down with your prospective employer and you discuss what you'll have to do, when and how, and then you get to the point, important point, of your salary or your wage. And let's just say, for the sake of argument, you agree on $20 an hour to be paid. Here's what you know, even if you never read a word of Marx's argument, because Marx's argument will speak to you. Here's what you know. There is no way the employer will give you $20 an hour for the use of your work time, your brains, your muscles, working on what he gives you and working in the way that he specifies. That will never happen unless, during that hour, your labor adds more to what that business has to sell than $20 worth. In other words, your labor adds value to the goods and services your employer has to sell greater than what he pays you to come there and do it. That's why he hires you. You produce more than you are paid. You produce a surplus, as the slaves did, although in a different way, as the serfs did, in a different way. And then the bulk of Marx's economic analysis follows this by showing that the surplus is used by the employer to sustain a system, politically, culturally, and in every other way, that keeps this system going precisely because the capitalist is sitting at the top of it, in the catbird seat, in the place you want to be in an exploitative, surplus-generating system. And the whole host of arguments and analyses that Marxists have developed are critical of capitalism because of this way of organizing the production and distribution of surpluses. And please notice, Marx is not here primarily a critic of markets. He didn't like them much, but that was not his focus. Likewise, he wasn't a big critic of ownership. It was not his major focus. He thought who owned things was important, by all means. And he thought whether you use markets or planning, that's important too. But these were not the topics of his books and articles by and large. He focused his most important analytical work, especially in the three volumes of his book, Capital, on the production relationship, how surplus gets produced by the majority, settles in the hands of a minority, and that minority then constructs and maintains a system based on this exploitative organization of the surplus. And in Marx's judgment, capitalism's inequalities, injustices, crises, and a whole host of other problems, many of which we're living through now, have to do with this organization of production. And by the way, did he imagine that we could have an economic system in which there was no surplus? No. The point is not that there is one. The point is, who gets it and what do they do with it? And his basic idea was always that the way you overcome and fix the problems of capitalism is a simple solution. Make the people who produce the surplus identical to the same people who get it and decide what to do with it, rather than have a separate group of people whose interests are in getting the maximum surplus, which squeezes what the mass of people get, versus the mass of people who want to squeeze the surplus to get a higher wage. That kind of conflict at the core of our production system is inefficient, dysfunctional, and fundamentally undemocratic and unjust. That's Marx's argument. My point is not to persuade you, but to understand this is a sophisticated, theoretically worked out point of view, and no one is smarter or better capable of understanding our economic system who doesn't use the insights this theory approaches and produces alongside those of theories that celebrate capitalism. As we turn now to the final portion of our weekly program, I want to talk a little bit about one of the kinds of cooperative enterprises that we feature, where we explain that these are already existing around the world and around the United States, and that much can be learned from their origins and the way they work. This time we're talking about a company located in Colorado. In fact, it has two offices, one in Boulder and one in Denver. It's called Namaste Solar. It's a company with 40 co-owners and employee owners. Everybody who works there is an equal decider of what the company does. Everyone who works there is a co-owner and makes all the decisions that go with that kind of ownership. It is a workers' co-op, proud of itself and proud of what it has accomplished. Here's its origin. An election, November 2004. Citizens of Colorado had been trying for years to get a legal change through the legislature mandating that at least 5 or 10% of the electricity generated in Colorado for Colorado residents, businesses, and individuals would come from renewable sources, not be dependent on oil and the conventional fossil fuels. And they had been beaten in the legislature over and over again, particularly by the electric utility companies led by Xcel Energy, which were opposed to it because it wasn't good for their profitability. Then they decided to put it up for a vote. And, of course, Xcel Energy and other utility companies and their allies worked very hard and spent freely to defeat the ballot initiative, famously called Amendment 37, in that election. But to the surprise of many, the Renewable Energy Access campaign won, and it became the law suddenly in Colorado, when most people had been sure it wouldn't, that renewable energy has a place in the Colorado economy. In came a group of ecologically committed young people who saw that solar energy was a way to use the renewable resource of the sun to provide the electricity that the people of Colorado had voted for. And in the opportunity created, and in the relative failure of other companies, capitalists, utilities, and so on, to imagine that any of this could happen, they found an extraordinary opportunity, and they have been pursuing this opportunity quite successfully. The company has grown. Here are a couple of the interesting dimensions of this 40-member worker co-op. All co-op owners participate in democratic decision-making on a one-person, one-vote basis. We maintain a 4-to-1 maximum ratio of the highest to the lowest total compensation per employee. Let me repeat that. The highest paid member of this co-op cannot get more than 4 times the lowest. That's the maximum range. Let me remind you that in most large corporations in the United States, the top employee, the CEO, typically gets 200 to 400 times what the lowest paid worker does. Finally, co-owners receive, ready, 6 weeks of paid time off each year, including holidays and sick time. Profit sharing is done equally. Wow. Nobody gets a particular bonus. Bonuses are company-wide. If anyone gets them, all of them get them. And 100% transparency. Everything this company does is open and known and available to every one of the workers in it. Namaste Solar in Colorado. Let me turn now to your questions and comments. I'm going to start with one from Chris Hemmings in Virginia that has to do with this question. How do we deal with a worker self-directed enterprise? Because even though it may not choose to leave the country for the reasons we've often discussed, it may choose to get up and leave a particular community for another one somewhere else. And that would cause all kinds of dislocation in the community it left. And the question is, what do we do about that? Because that raises questions of justice and economics and so on. I tried to deal with this in my book, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, so let me summarize briefly what I argue there. When we advocate for the democratization of enterprises, for literally converting our enterprises from the top-down, hierarchical, and undemocratic structure they have now, where all decisions are made by boards of directors and major shareholders, and everybody else has to live with the results without participating in making those decisions, when we criticize that and propose a democratic workplace, a cooperative where the workers not only do the work but also make the decisions, we assumed, and perhaps we should have been more clear about it, that this would be in cooperation with democratic residential cities, towns, and neighborhoods. In other words, it seems to us crystal clear that the decisions made by an enterprise impact the communities with which it interacts, where its workers live, where the work site exists, how that affects the air, the traffic patterns, the lives of the people in the community. And likewise, the decisions made by a neighborhood or a city or a state certainly impact companies and enterprises and how they work and their profitability and all the rest. Since it's clear that the enterprise and the residential region, from neighborhood to the whole country, interact with one another, then democracy requires that they cooperate and together make the basic decisions. So here's what it would mean. Part of the decisions made by a company, a worker self-directed company, have to have input from the communities impacted by what the company does. There's no shortcut around this. There'll have to be representatives or some kind of organized participation by local residents, regional residents, in the decisions a company makes because those residents are impacted by the company's decisions. And likewise, worker self-directed enterprises would have to have some input, some power over the decisions made in local communities and for the exact same reason. Those local communities make decisions that impact on the workers. The point is, in our society, we have to some degree the principle, at least, of a democratic process where we live. we don't have one where we work. And if we established one where we work, there would have to be a co-determination of major decisions by both democracies, the one based where we live and the one based where we work. And that's why we believe that democracy would be advanced and decisions like moving from one community to another would be only possible to the degree that the community itself was involved in the decision and was protected and compensated if it was going to be left, and that that was part of an ongoing negotiation, just like decisions of the community that might negatively impact a worker self-directed enterprise would have to compensate and work that out. It would mean a change in the way we organize our political and economic relationships, but that's hardly surprising if we're going to make a change as big as one from a capitalist to a worker cooperative enterprise organization. Finally, I want to deal with a question about a debate among Marxist economists. And this debate is referred to by a number of you, and it goes something like this. Some Marxist economists, looking at the current global crisis, think that it is caused by working people not having enough purchasing power to buy the goods and services capitalists are producing, and therefore the system breaks down. Another group doesn't think that's the key cause at all. It thinks that built into the way capitalists work is a program of investments that tends to depress the rate of profit over time, till it gets so low that capitalists don't want to invest anymore because the profit isn't high enough. This is often called in Marxian debates the tendency for the rate of profit to fall, and the first one, when the mass of people don't have enough money to buy goods and services, is called, not surprisingly, underconsumption. So for 100 years, Marxists have debated, maybe more than that, whether the crises of capitalism are caused by underconsumption or by the tendency for the rate of profit to fall, as if we had to come up with, in some sense, those who are interested in Marxian economics, with an either-or. Namely, it's this or it's that. Well, I must admit, I don't read Marx that way. I think he was much more complicated than that. I think he understood, or at least I get it from when I read it, that there were many ways that a capitalist system could stumble and fall. After all, economic crises happen every few years, and they've been happening for 2 centuries of capitalism. So we have lots of examples where all kinds of mechanisms broke down. And I think it was Marx's strength that his books were, in a sense, a kind of catalog of all the different ways this system is, as he liked to say, self-contradictory, full of mechanisms that can spin it out of control. Look, here we are in a global crisis, started in 2007, and despite everything that the government tries to do and whatever the private corporations are doing, we haven't gotten out of it. We're still in it. And for many people, it's getting worse. This is not a system that self-corrects very well. And I know all the scapegoats being pointed at and all the bad things this one is asserting that one did. But the bottom line is, the system isn't working real well. And if Marx were around, I think he'd smile. He'd say, look, read my work. I showed all the different mechanisms that can come into play. Now it's this one, now it's that one, now it's this combination of factors, now it's that. The point of my work, Marx, I think, would tell us, is that you see all the things that make this a system that is always functioning, but also fragile, building itself up, but also undermining itself. So that if you are critical of it, there are lots of ways to see opportunities for changing it, and there are lots of moments in its development when all sorts of people will be open to a criticism. I don't frankly think it's productive. to have debates that this is the key cause of crisis or that is. There are too many factors that can come together in too many ways to make this system stop working well. We can focus on one or another of them when it's important to do that because it plays a major role. But there's no need for some abstract debate that this is more important than that when the real issue is to understand how this system basically works and to figure out from there what all the factors are in any particular moment of history that create the opportunity for questions, debates, and change that are better for everyone who lives with an unstable system like capitalism. That's the contribution Marxists at their best have done, and I think that's the way to go for them. Thank you very much for your attention. We've come to the end of another economic update. This is Richard Wolff, hoping you'll join me again next week.
You'll try now, baby. After a while, going to do mine, won't be mine. One of these days, baby, I'm moaning, droning, baby. Try, try, mine. Won't be long, long. Thing gonna change. Sometime in the middle of the night, it gets so long, it's so long, it's so long. Thing gonna change.